So I now call upon our brother Brian to lead us under the study of Isaiah chapter 32. A king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment.
Thanks, Brother Greg. And tonight it's all about a sweeping change of government, so that's rather a suitable comment, isn't it? I didn't know about that until Greg announced it, so. But did you enjoy, my dear brothers and sisters, our opening hymn tonight? Number 25, if you just got it there for a minute. I draw attention to it because our opening hymn and our closing hymn are both on one section of the scripture. What section of the scripture is that? What's this one about? Psalm 72, that's right. It's a paraphrase of Psalm 72. The just shall flourish in his days, in the days of a righteous king. O Lord, thy judgments give the king, his son thy righteousness. With right he shall thy people judge, with poor, thy poor with upright. Written by King David in the last days of his life, when it was in fact from his natural seed a young man to come upon the throne. So that's the kind of suitable background. Solomon is to become king, and David, exalted by that thought, sketches Psalm 72. It's right at the end of his life, because it says at the end of the psalm, it says the words, the prayers of David the son of Jesse are ended. And so he goes and Solomon comes on. So Solomon is the type of yet something greater, of a greater son of David, which caused the people in Jesus' day cried out to him, Jesus, thou son of David. So he's the king that is going to receive the judgment. So Lord, thy judgments give the king, his son thy righteousness. There is an imparting to the next generation. With right he shall thy people judge, thy poor with uprightness. His glorious dominion from sea to sea shall extend. It from the river shall reach forth unto earth's utmost end. There will be no square mile where it will not reach. For he the needy, verse 5, shall preserve. When he to him doth call, the poor also, and him that hath no help of man at all. What a different regime that is. What an incredibly wonderful thing. What a beautiful thing on Wednesday night to come and stand up and sing those sentiments. And to just change the whole environment of whatever day it might have been at the office or wherever. And we are very privileged, my dear brothers and sisters, to have that picture in our mind, aren't we? To be able to come and to see that picture and to exalt our minds in it. Because God is still working. Never mind all the tempo of the world outside and the pressures, as indicated by the sudden death tactics, as it were, that Brother Greg has mentioned in the political world. God is working. And good things are happening. There's been baptisms here. And other good things are happening. Yesterday I was told about our headmaster who took the children over to the Rams Oval. Sounds a strange thing, doesn't it? But he took them over to the Rams Oval because, you know, we're building an oval out there at the school. We have to have a nice big playing area. And we're quite strapped for the budget in 97, obviously. There's a lot of big things to be done, so we've got to be very careful about the budget. So, you know, how do you include an oval in a budget? Can you afford to include an oval in a budget? So we talked about, you know, what we might have to get in terms of loam or soil onto this area to make it all nice and level and reasonable for sowing of the grass seed. And it looked like it might cost us $12 or $15 a ton, and we might need 1,000 ton. So it gets a lot of money, doesn't it? You really start to think twice about how you're going to do it. And then as Brother James was going home last Thursday or Friday night from the school area, he saw this gentleman who's doing a bit of developing out there close to us. They got talking. He said to him, just by the way, what are you doing down the back there? And Brother James said, well, we're trying to build an oval. We're a bit strapped for funds, but we're trying to build an oval. Oh, he said, is that what's happening? He said, "What's the matter?" Well, he said, "We've got a lot of soil to get. It's quite expensive." He said, "Why don't you go up to the Rams? You know, where they are, just in front of us, towards Foster's Road." So the upshot of that is that the Rams are pulling up their oval. Just this week. They're pulling up their oval. Perfectly good as far as I can see, but I'm not going to argue. And they're pulling it up by 40 or 50 centimetres. Now that's a lot of ground, isn't it? In fact, it's 5,000 tonnes of ground. We only want 1,000 tonnes. And now we've got 1,000 tonnes, or whatever we need anyway. It's all been lobbed there yesterday and today for the sum total of havoc is how much? Nothing. So I thought that was lovely. The headmaster took his children over and he said, "See all these big front-end loaders all gouging into this beautiful turf and loading it up in all these big trucks that we don't own. We don't own the front-end loaders. And over it goes, you know, just 200 or 300 yards, and lobs it on the Christadelphians school oval, well, potentially. And we've done nothing, have we?" Now, isn't that absolutely remarkable? And he said to the kiddies, well, he said, "Surely that's another evidence of the good hand of our God." And I can't help feel that that's true, my dear brothers and sisters. If we put our hand to a good thing, if we put our hand solidly to something which is going to save our children, in these days, I believe God will bless that. But we've got to have the foresight, and we've got to have the clear perception that that's essential. And the evidence that it is essential is everywhere in our brotherhood today. Our children under terrible pressure. And it's just simply a wonderful thing to see that going ahead and just, you know, yet again to be buoyed up and enthused by the obvious hand of a wonderful God upon us. If we put our hand to a good work faithfully, then I'm sure he will bless us in that work. We have in the 32nd chapter of Isaiah, one of the chapters probably more frequently quoted than most others in this wonderful book, this overall wonderful book. The whole term, the whole tone changes through this 32nd chapter as it goes on to speak in some of the most eloquent ways of the coming of the kingdom, until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, verse 15, and the wilderness be a fruitful field. The fruitful field be counted for a forest. Everything's upgraded, stepped up. Judgment shall dwell in the wilderness. That is anywhere, everywhere. And righteousness remain in the fruitful field. And the work of righteousness shall be peace. And the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. King shall reign in righteousness. That's the word of the chapter, without a shadow of a doubt. It's a chapter of a reign of righteousness, of coming righteousness upon the earth. And it's a delightful thing to conceive in that opening phrase, which we're going to think about and dwell upon for some time. A king shall reign in righteousness. Does that strike you? Ever seen it? We really don't see a king reigning today, do we? Not really. There are a few kings, the kings of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and so forth. They are reigning kings, but they're not great effective kings today. We don't really see a king reigning. We have a queen, but she reigns, but in a sense she doesn't really reign, does she? She is a figurehead really today, and it's been like that for some couple of hundred years. But this is a king. It is a male monarch, and he is reigning. It is monarchy, single reign, one person reigning. It is efficient, clean, swift. There is direction and character in a monarchy. And this king, though he has all that to hand, is reigning in righteousness. This king is interested in his people, not himself. This king is reigning for them, for their good and for the good of his God upon them. That's what it means to reign in righteousness. And it really is, when you stand back and look at it, my dear brothers and sisters, it's enough to cause you a sense of great thrill and enjoyment, isn't it? Just to read those words. And to think what a fantastic difference that is. That a king shall reign in righteousness. What a wonderful sense of authority was in that. Do you know, this subject just cannot help but go back to David all the time. It's one of the things that's really impressed me with the chapter. It's the dear and wonderful king, King David, that sets the tone of this. In the 2nd of Kings, we've already looked, 2nd of Samuel, we've already looked, haven't we, at his Psalm 72. 2nd of Kings 23. This connection of a king and righteousness, that the king must be righteous. It really is a fundamental, essential thought, so rarely seen in all the centuries of mankind's government. But it's here in 2 Samuel 23, in what are styled the last words of David, that note is struck in the most beautiful and singular manner. David saw it with all the force of compulsion. The Spirit of Yahweh, we'll read verse 1 so we understand. Now these be the last words of David, see? It's written at a very similar time, make a little note there, as Psalm 72. Because the last words of Psalm 72 were, the prayers of David the son of Jesse are ended. That's why it's Psalm 72. Because it's after 71, and 71 says, now that I am old and grey-headed, forsake me not. See, it's in David's old age. That's why those psalms are put together like that. 70, 69, 71, 72, 69, 70, and 71, and 72 are all there as psalms of David's old age. And so these words need to be coupled with that. And singularly, my dear brothers and sisters, in a wonderful way, they're all about the same thing, aren't they? What was David's last words? It's Psalm 72. And it's all about a king reigning in righteousness and all the good effects of that throughout the world. Just what an old man would think about. Wonderful, wonderful words. That's what was really bubbling up in his heart. I remember an old brother that we had in our meeting. His name just slipped my memory. He and his wife, they went up to New Guinea, John, come on. Pardon? Yeah, old brother Evans. I never forget going visiting him in his last few weeks of his life. And you know, he could sit there and recite to you Psalm 72. Luke 21 and Psalm 72, just about word for word. Isn't that interesting? See, it was a singular thought in that psalm. And he was an old man too. What was in his heart? He came into the truth, didn't he, when he was already a man, some 70 odd years. But that was what was in his heart, Psalm 72, just like David, see. He'd just sit there when he couldn't barely remember your name. He just only knew really a half a dozen people. He lost contact really with all the names of the things and other happenings. But he could cite to you Psalm 72. See? This is similar, isn't it? What's bubbling in David's mind? Well, powers are receding. Abilities are going. His houses have been in ruins. There have been all kinds of different difficulties in his life. David, the son of Jesse, said in his last words, the man who was raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel said, the Spirit of Yahweh spake by me. And his word was in my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spake to me. This is what he said. This is the lesson of my life. The theme of my life. The one thing I remember, as it were, about what God's spoken to me. This is it. He that ruleth over men must be a righteous one. There it is. The king shall reign in righteousness. See? It's all just a paraphrase, isn't it? Of David's last words. Ruling in the fear of God. He'll do righteousness for his fellows because he rules in the fear of God.
His mind is toward his God, and therefore he does well for his fellows. And he'll treat his subjects well because he has a fear and love of Almighty God. He shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds. As the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. And there's our Isaiah 32, right in there. Until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high. Although my house be not so with God, with strength, with ale, as it is, yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and sure, for this is all my salvation and all my desire. Although I'll have to wait, he maketh it not to grow, to shoot forth at that time. Old man, what's his picture? Love of the kingdom, isn't it? He's seen all the things that he's seen in his life. He knows that's what we want. And what was required? He that ruleth over men must be a righteous one, ruling in the fear of God. What a beautiful, beautiful statement. So you can see how that just links with Psalm 72. Absolutely beautifully. And so, of course, it has a very real connection with our chapter tonight. And that's the ringing first note of our chapter. Now, if you come over to Jeremiah, a little bit later than Isaiah, of course, there's a very, very enthralling passage here that really connects in a very bold and wonderful way this theme of reigning and righteousness. Jeremiah 23, then, verse 5. One of the great chapters, great themes of Jeremiah. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch. And that's the same word. That pen's escaped again. It seems to have legs, that pen, doesn't it? Oh, good on you, Dan. Thank you. Now you've got to work out which way to take it off. That word for righteous is the word Zadok. You remember we used to have a brother called to see us from Western Australia whose name was Brian Sadiq, remember? Well, that's just one of the ways of spelling it in English. Zadok meaning righteous. Okay, that's verse 5, a Zadok branch. Right? Then it says, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. And that word is the word justice, and it's very much related to this, as you'll see. Oh, if I was Uncle Alan, I'd probably just put something up there and get away with it, but I'll try and get it right. I better be careful, he's here tonight. There we are. Sadaka, meaning justice or righteousness. At least you can read them from. This is righteous. And then just in the next verse, that's twice already, isn't it?
The next verse. In his days shall Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely. And this is the name whereby he shall be called Yahweh, our righteousness.
And that's the same word again as what we just had. So there it is again. One, two, three. Where's all that theme coming from? It's the dominant spirit of those two verses, isn't it? It just sort of suddenly erupts in the chapter of Jeremiah chapter 23. There's all kinds of trouble about whoever's going to reign from Josiah's lineage in the previous chapter. There's all terrible, terrible plight. Who the dickens is going to reign? All of a sudden, out of the chapter erupts this. This is the man that will reign. And it's full of the terms of David's last words. Full of the expressions of Psalm 72. It reiterates the sentiments of our chapter in Isaiah chapter 32. It's about a king, and it's all about righteousness, about a righteous branch, and about Yahweh, our righteousness. And you know, the yearning ache of the world is for a person to rule all nations with equity and righteousness. Decent, equitable, fair, wise government. It's the ache of the nations, isn't it? As we said before, a king reigns efficiently, cleanly, and with character. But the almost universal experience of a king in government has been this. What's the little phrase that everybody speaks about? Yeah, but how does it start? You're right, Pete, but how does it start? Now, when I was young, I heard that, and I used to think, "Oh, that's a bit strong." But you know, it's really proven to be a very true proverb. That little proverb: power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It doesn't have to be a king on the sort of top of authority on his throne. It's just true of men. As they go through life and become more and more powerful, more and more authoritative, more and more wealthy, more and more achievements and attainments, power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's a very true thing. Very, very true. You see it, you know, in our own world, but you see it particularly in the areas of the world where the tyrant who gets on the top can be so much aloof from his people. I remember, for example, when I was in South Africa visiting one of the black villages, as they were at that time. Well, it wasn't a village, it was really quite a numerous city. And all of a sudden, in this real shanty town, goes past this great Mercedes Benz. It took about 30 minutes to go past, it was that long. And it was a gaudy red car, magnificent looking car. And I thought, oh, here comes the Prime Minister. But it wasn't, it was just the local mayor. You know, and that's how things were in that township. And he just lives miles above those people. You know, for all that the world says about Mr. Mandela and so forth, you ought to see the type of pompous luxury that he and his administration enjoy. Next door to him, just to the north of him, is Mr. Mugabe. Mr. Mugabe was a Marxist school teacher when he went into the jungle in the times of Mr. Smith, when the whites were running Rhodesia, as it was called, now called Zimbabwe. And that man today, after what, 15 to 20 years of government, is reckoned among the 20 richest men in the world. His population's divided into his own type of people, who are in the north, who now have all the government offices and public service, and the Matabele in the south, whose diet consists of whatever they can find plus ants. Exceedingly poor. And that man is sitting now above them just harvesting all the wealth of that country. And vesting it, of course, in the silent banks, the silent bank accounts of Switzerland. And that's the kind of thing that's right around the world. Wherever possible, that's the sort of thing we find. Here we're talking about a king in absolute authority, not just over one country or an area, or just not over an empire. He's over all nations. A king shall reign. He has absolute authority in righteousness. Isn't that beautiful? You don't feel the power of that, do you, until you stop and think about what that really is saying. And the only way that could possibly be the case
is dramatically illustrated in our world again. And it was indicated by what God said concerning the king. Just ask the question, how could that be the case that a king would reign in righteousness? What did God say to the king? What was the one thing he must do? What was it? Come on, you all know. I'm getting tired of asking questions when I know you all know. Tell me. What was the one thing that king had to do? He had to rule in the fear of God, yes. Ah, thank you. He had to write out a copy of the law. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, that's what he was told to do. He wasn't allowed to do this, that and the other, multiply horses and a few other things. Horses and wives, I don't know why they were put together, but they were. But he wasn't allowed to multiply them. But what he was told he must do is write out a copy of the law. And you know, one of the dramatic things of the last 5 or 10 years has been to see the sad, tragic falling of the English royal family. And it really amplifies that principle. Time and again I thought to myself, why ever is that family in this kind of bind? Surely, with everything they had to lose, they could have walked straight. But no. I mean, could you think of a boy in all the world that had more to lose than young Prince Charles? There was no shadow of a doubt about it. There was more honour resting on him, his soldiers, and what he looked to inherit than any other young man in the world. You just think about it. It's true, isn't it? There's no other young man in the world that had so much to gain, as far as this world is concerned, than Prince Charles. But he could not walk straight. Neither could his sister. Neither could his brother. Neither could their wives. You think to yourself, but why weren't they told to do this? Why ever did they become so loose? And the reason is what God said to the king. You'll write that copy of the law out and you'll keep it by your side. You'll read it and read it and read it and read it. You see, Prince Charles is not a Bible student, is he? His mother might have been to some degree. But what it means is that even in the top echelons of society that might, some 20 years ago, seem to have been so proper and so dignified, where things wouldn't be done that were really evil, it wasn't true. When society relaxed, it was found that right up into those echelons, it was corrupt, filthy, rotten. They went to parties and they did the sort of things that all the commoners did as well. And they'd be doing it for some years. And the thing that was necessary for that young man was to have a fear of God, as somebody rightly said, and to have the word of God that he might have the fear of God. Isn't that a dramatic lesson? And so our consideration of a king reigning in righteousness is predicated on that basis. He's got to have in his mind daily. That's got to be sparking away in his mind. And you know why, dear brothers, it's no different for you and me, is it? Absolutely no different. To live in this world and to live positively for the things of God and to be thinking in the interests of the truth of God and the brotherhood and our ecclesia and our young people and our family and all those things, which we should be thinking about, requires a pumping force, doesn't it? It does, there's no doubt about it. It requires us to have that going through our mind, doesn't it? Well, it won't happen. We'll be too tired, can't get there. Won't do it tonight. Haven't got enough time to do it. Something else comes along. But to have that, it requires a pumping drive. And that drive is the word of God. So what we see lacking, say, in the likes of Prince Charles, teaches us that graphic lesson, but it goes right back to the original words to a king. In Deuteronomy 17, he's got to have God's word in his heart. He'll never make it without it. Or he'll do what that says. He'll think he can wangle things his own way, irrespective of the knowledge of God and the knowledge that God sees all things. And he'll be corrupted. And the higher he goes, the worse he will get. Come, we've looked at the hymn. Come and look at the psalm itself, Psalm 72. Undoubtedly it is David, the lovely mind of David, with all that he went through in his life, that got hold of this theme of a king and righteousness, of reigning and justice. It was David that brought this through into the greater awareness of Israel and to her people and us as well. Look at the emphasis here. What an instruction this is. Look at it. Verse 1. Give the king thy judgments, O God. Thy judgments. The right way you think and the right way you judge. Give the king thy judgments. That is to Solomon, but to greater than Solomon, to the Lord Jesus Christ. And thy righteousness unto the king's son. What was that one thing that God told him that a man who reigns must needs have? That he must rule in the fear of God. And he must be a righteous man. There it is. Give the king thy judgments, O God, and thy righteousness unto the king's son. He shall judge thy people with righteousness, and thy poor with judgment. Taking the words from verse 1. The mountains shall bring peace to the people, and the little hills by righteousness. In his days, verse 7, shall the righteous flourish. An abundance of peace. You know, it's his theme, isn't it? Isn't that lovely? A theme of the last days of that illustrious and wonderful old king. And he saw that. All the things that had happened in his life. What a life he had. Full of a mixed, it was a real mixed bag, wasn't it, in David's life? And yet through all of that, there was a truly wonderful mind, glorious mind. And through it all, he could see, having put it all behind him, with just a few more days of mortal life, hours perhaps, he could see that what the world wanted and desperately needed, what it ached for, was a righteous monarch. Now, if we come back to our chapter, we become aware that we can't just look at a thing in Isaiah unless we look at its context. A king shall reign in righteousness. Well, in the last two verses of chapter 31, it's speaking about another king. Then shall the Assyrian fall with the sword. The Assyrian? What, one man? Well, collectively, as it were, represented in the king. Not of a mighty man, and the sword not of a mean man, shall devour him. But he shall flee from the sword, and his young men shall be discomforted. And he, singular, shall pass over to his stronghold for fear. As he did, he went back to Assyria. And his princes shall be afraid of the ensign, saith Yahweh, whose fire is in Zion and his furnace in Jerusalem. He said he will go back to his land with his tail between his legs, as it were, greatly humbled, and his princes will be in astonishment of what has happened. That's exactly true. That happened to Sennacherib, who was that Assyrian, the he. He's not far away, because just when in the previous chapter, in the last verse of the previous chapter, he was named. In Isaiah 30 now, in verse 33, for Tophet is ordained of old, yea, for the king it is prepared. And that king, of course, is Sennacherib, who was the head of the Assyrian, verse 31, who was to be beaten down. So, when therefore the final words of chapter 31 were being conceived, they were being directed at the eclipse of Sennacherib. And so 32 verse 1 is like a glorious reaction to the eclipse and downfalling of the great king of Assyria. Down he came, and into the very mouth of that, God provides a picture
of Zion's glorious king in righteousness. Not a wolf coming upon the fold, as Byron describes Sennacherib, a fierce and ferocious, deadly man he was. Capable, gifted leader, but he was a wicked man. And out of that, having put that aside, having buried his forces in the valley of the son of Hinnom, in Tophah, in the furnace of God's displeasure, he went back home and his sons destroyed him. And a king shall reign in righteousness. Isn't that lovely? What God is doing is obvious, isn't it? You know, in the contest, it was very much a contest between Sennacherib, the person, the man, and between Hezekiah, the king in Jerusalem. Hezekiah on behalf of God, on behalf of the true and living God. Now I want to illustrate that. Come to chapter 36. In 36 verse 4, this is the man that was knocking at the doors through his lieutenant, Rabshakeh. 36 verse 4. And Rabshakeh said unto them, say ye now to Hezekiah. Rabshakeh was the head of his forces. Thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Very personal, isn't it? Very personal. It's the vauntings of a singular man. And it is all through this chapter. It's all about the king of Assyria. Verse 1 of chapter 36. Came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fenced cities. Verse 2. The king of Assyria sent. Verse 8 even, right down at the end of the chapter. Down the end of that column. Now therefore give pledges, I pray thee, to my master the king of Assyria. See, it's a very personalised encounter, wasn't it? It was Sennacherib versus who? Versus a small, domestic almost, weak, ill king who's lost all his domains, all his cities, 48 of them at least, in ruins. I smashed them all down. He's only just got to chop off the head of this final one and it's all done. It's finished. The job's done. And what's more, Hezekiah at this time was sick nigh unto death. Just like Jacob, who wanted his strength at the time he was to meet Esau, so Hezekiah, when he desperately needed the natural strength for his mind and body to give leadership, he lost it. As the record tells us in this same chapter, in chapter 38. In those days was Hezekiah sick unto death. So you've got to put that back into the record. There's poor Hezekiah. You know, who would you bet upon? If the betting booths were out then, my dear friends, who would they put their money upon? The great king of Assyria. And inside that city there was a little group that stood with him. They'd come in from the countryside in the peril of their lives. Everyone else had gone. The city once used to have many other great people, but bit by bit they got off somewhere else. Some to Egypt, some to the countryside, somewhere else. And in there was a group of people who believed in Hezekiah and Isaiah and the God that they worshipped, who had promised them Shear Jashub, a remnant shall return. And they believed the message of that little boy that was trotting around with Isaiah saying, a remnant shall return. A remnant shall return. And the question to you and I, my dear brothers, always comes powerfully, doesn't it, out of that. Would we have hung on? What would we have done? I've asked myself that question many, many times. What would we have done? Would we have stayed in that city? Didn't have very great walls for Sennacherib. Busted everything else up in the world. Why wouldn't he smash Jerusalem? What is he going to do with this thing?
Tremendous issue it was, wasn't it?
So that increasingly there was a spirit of unifying faith in that little city as the Shear Jashub was being made against all human odds. And the great king of Assyria saw it just like that, and he threw his fist and boasted about what he would do. And Hezekiah is sick, and the people are putting their strength in Hezekiah's God, all the things that he represented. Well, they would have remembered, you see, this beautiful chapter, which led after the destruction of the Assyrians, said, "Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment." That's what they would have remembered. It's going to happen. And it's going to be for the remnant that hold on. Now, in the 37th chapter, again, just to sort of feel the power of that, you must notice in this chapter, chapter 37 of Isaiah, verse 3 and 4, verse 2 to 4, this sense of a gathering unification of faithful followers. When Hezekiah heard the message, he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of Yahweh. And he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priests covered with sackcloth, unto Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos. My dear brothers and sisters, they're not going up to some great palace. No way. Isaiah would have been in that city with a very humble dwelling, a door that swung open to any soul, high or low, whoever wanted to spend some time with him, a man of the people. And here's this deputation from the king in sackcloth, in the crisis of their life. And they say unto him, "Thus saith Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and of rebuke and of blasphemy. For the children are come to the birth, and there is not strength to bring forth. We've clung on to this very time. We've striven to be faithful to our God. But there is not strength to bring forth. We'll never be able to overcome this." You can feel absolutely how they felt, can't you? "It may be Yahweh thy God," Isaiah. Who was the closest to God in that place? "It may be Yahweh thy God." See that? Isaiah is the closest to the God of Israel, that he will hear the words of Rabshakeh. "Then the king of Assyria, his master, hath sent to reproach the living God, and will reprove the words which Yahweh thy God hath heard. Wherefore lift up the prayer, thy prayer, for the remnant that is left." Now mark that clearly in your Bible. That's who it was for. For the remnant that is left. And that tells us that whoever was left still in that city was of a similar frame of mind. They had hung on. They had tried to keep there and to stay there. They felt desperately inadequate. The children had come to the birth, but not able to bring forth. Like a woman caught halfway, as it were, and she can't bring forth the child. What a desperate plight that is. And that's how they felt. They were so close, but so far away. "Wherefore lift up thy prayer for the remnant that is left." Did God care? Was he interested in the child? Was he involved in their prayers and their thoughts? Had he heard them? "Because thy rage," verse 29, "thy rage against me," and the words of God through Isaiah, "and thy tumult is come up into mine ears. Therefore will I put my hook in thy nose and my bridle in thy lips. And I will turn thee back by the way which thou camest. And this shall be a sign unto thee. Ye shall eat this year such as groweth of itself, and the second year that which springeth of the same. And in the third year sow ye and reap, and plant vineyards and eat the fruit thereof." Who for? "And the remnant that is escaped of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, and they that escape out of Mount Zion, the zeal of Yahweh of hosts shall do this. Isn't that beautiful language? God's passionate response. Lift up thy voice in prayer for the remnant that is left, the remnant that is escaped. Says God in graphic language, shall put their roots down, and up will come that planting, powerfully, prosperous. For out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant. Isn't that lovely? Did God hear? Was he involved? Was he passionately with his people? Does he care about us, my dear and sisters? Little group of unified faithful in the world, trying to stay by the promises made to the line of David and the destiny of Jerusalem, the return of Israel. Does he care? Does he hear us? Because we stand for truth in a world that couldn't care less. There's your answer. He took the very words that came from Eliakim and he put those in his reply that came through Isaiah. He hears. That's why we got the soil today. He is a living God and he hears our prayers and he will surely deliver us from all things, never mind how grim it might seem. That remnant were going to be saved, and God would see that that would indeed be the case. Now, if we, coming back to that chapter, sort of think of that. Right. Sennacherib's gone. Syria's gone. What do you think that does to the whole Middle East? Egypt hears the message. What? 185,000 soldiers there were. Yes, they were. They what? I'll go on with you. Couldn't be possibly be true. What about over there in Ammon, in Moab, in Edom? Are you saying that the Assyrians gone? A messenger comes, breathless? Impossible. Well, what did Hezekiah do? Did he have an atomic bomb or something? How did he get rid of them? Well, they're gone. They're finished. They're all dead men. They're burying them in hundreds of thousands. Could you believe that? Well, there's no doubt many messengers that came before that would have gone back to have a look with their own eyes. As it says in chapter 66, they will in the future to see those people that rose up against Yahweh that will be destroyed in that place. No doubt it was the case then too. For it says of Hezekiah, when we come back into the 2 Chronicles chapter 32, it says that this occasioned such fame among the nations that his administration was henceforth internationally famous. In 2 Chronicles 32, thus Yahweh saved Hezekiah, verse 22 of chapter 32, he saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and from the hand of all other. See? Yahweh saved them from the hand of all other. And he became involved in that nation in a way that had never been seen before. He guided them on every side. You'll only get an expression like that in 2 Samuel 5 in respect to David's reign. He guided them on every side. David saw that Yahweh had blessed him in all things. Remember it says that in 2 Samuel chapter 5. Well, here you've got the same thing. God's really come into that little remnant. And people would have come in and seen Hezekiah, and his administrators would be extremely honoured, wouldn't they? Look, it says in verse 23, many brought gifts unto Yahweh to Jerusalem, presents to Hezekiah, king of Judah, so that he was magnified in the sight of all nations from henceforth, and those who reigned with him. The little Mr. and Mrs. Insignificant, brother and sister, you know, just down the street, had nothing much more than their sandals on. They came in from the village, but they came to Jerusalem because they believed that God would save Jerusalem according to what he said. They were in the city. They became administrators later on. People came and looked at them and saw them as the glorious remnant of faithful people that had stood with the king and with Isaiah. There was Shear Jashub, What a man he was then. There was Mayor Shalal Hashbaz. What a man of notoriety he was at that time. Men that had stood in faith for the right things. A king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment. It wasn't just a Hezekiah. It was a whole retinue of other faithful people that were reigning with the king at that time. Now, of course, when we think of the scope of this chapter, if you swing your eye across, say, to verse 15, you're undoubtedly in times of the kingdom, aren't you? And so there's a second application of this king reigning in righteousness to the Lord Jesus Christ. And the princes that rule with him in judgment are, of course, the saints. Now, I want just to put a group of passages very quickly together that all teach that same concept of co-regency. Let's have a look at them quite quickly. The first one is in Psalm 45. I won't stop to elaborate them. I just want to put them together because, you know, not a lot of people in the world have ever seen what we understand, that he will make them kings and priests and reign with them upon the earth. Revelation 5 verse 10, isn't it? We all learnt that at our baptism. He hath made them kings and priests and shall rule with them upon the earth. Psalm 45 verse 16. Instead of thy fathers, this new king who reigns in Jerusalem, shall be thy children. They're the children of Isaiah 53 verse 10. By his knowledge shall my servant justify many. He shall see his seed. So he has seed in that sense. We are his seed, aren't we? Generated from him. So instead of thy fathers, instead of looking backwards down the line for illustrious folk, it shall be thy children. They will be the famous of the new generation. And thou mayest make princes, same word, Sar, S-A-R, in all the earth. All right? A king and princes. Daniel chapter 7. For those who are worried that we're not getting right through the chapter, we only have to get to verse 8, and this verse is the dominant verse, so relax. Daniel chapter 7, verse 18. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Verse 25, he shall speak great words against the Most High, shall wear out the saints of the Most High. But the judgment shall sit, verse 26, and the kingdom and dominion, verse 27, and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. That doesn't mean to say the people are different to the saints of the Most High. It's just the Hebrew way of saying it shall be given to the saints of the Most High. That's the people that to whom it will be given. Some people try to read that in a different way and get themselves all gobbled up. Doesn't mean that at all. It just means it's given to the saints. Right? There's two very good passages, isn't it? Well, you know Revelation 5 verse 10. We've already quoted that one. 2 Timothy 2 verse 12. Why don't other people speak about the saints reigning with Christ? Why don't they? Never been able to work it out yet. 2 Timothy 2 verse 12 is as clear in the scripture as anything ever could be. If we suffer, we shall also reign with him. Clear enough? Revelation 3 verse 21. To him that overcometh, it says in Revelation 3 verse 21, will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. They will sit with me in my throne. So there's a series of passages all teaching that very Christadelphian doctrine of the saints ruling with Christ. And then in verse 2 of Isaiah 32, it speaks of the beneficial effects of this new king's reign. It says, and a man
shall be as an hiding place from the wind. That's one element of his protection. A hiding place from the wind. Do you like wind? There's very few people like wind, is there? This man is going to be a hiding place from the wind. Usually find a wall, wouldn't you, or a shed, or some kind of tree or something, to find a hiding place from the wind. But this man shall be a hiding place from the wind. And it doesn't mean just the king of verse 1, does it? By implication, it means the king or any one of those princes are going to be as a hiding place from the wind. The second concept, a covert from the tempest. The third, as rivers of water in a dry place. Fourthly, as you might say, the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. Well, on all of those occasions, you've got the fortunes, the winds of fortune blowing against the person, see? The tide is against him. But in that time of stress and anguish, it says that at that time, as the great quality of this administration, it's the quality that is most mentioned. The great quality of that administration is that it will stand up for a man when he needs it. That's what it's saying. There's your administration, verse 1. And what's the overriding quality of that administration? It will stand up for a man when justice is required. And it will defend him. Whether it be the wind or the tempest, the storm, or the waters in a dry place, or whether it be in a weary land with the sun beating down upon that person. This administration is going to stand up for the individual and give him the succour and help that he needs at that time. Well, did that actually happen then? If we take it back to the days of Hezekiah, did that actually happen? Well, it certainly did happen, didn't it? As we saw, God cared for Hezekiah, and he cared for that remnant who were with him. And they became famous. Whatever could be found out in Judah, among the valleys and the caves and dens of the earth, they would have come out, wouldn't they? Out of their dens and caves and all of their hiding places and all the difficulties they've been in. And now God was working now with that remnant and the king and Isaiah. There was a different spirit in the city. An entirely different spirit in that city. Other people were coming from other nations. It's a picture of the kingdom, isn't it? Of course it is. It's a cameo of the kingdom in which Christ is there and the saints that have been faithful through all the vicissitudes of life and have stayed true to their calling, staying with their king. And the people come and learn of them. And that's exactly the picture we have of the future. That's exactly what would have happened in the days of Hezekiah when people came from all other places to learn of exactly what happened. What did they do when they brought presents? What, drop the present on the front doorstep at the palace and go off? Of course they didn't. They came to find out what happened. They would have gone down to Tophet and said, "You mean to say there's graves from here to here? How many did you say? Where's the riches of all this men, these people? What happened?" And so all the story would have been told, how this happened. And so people came to put their trust and confidence in this new administration, who one time were the poor and needy of Jerusalem, and who were disdained. They were looked down upon, never ever brought up into the ranks of notoriety before. But having come through that, these men of good disposition are a hiding place from the wind, a covert from the tempest. There is water in a dry place. They can provide for mankind because they've been through it themselves. They're a shadow of a great rock, even of the rock of Yahweh himself, to people in a weary land. Well, it's a delightful picture, isn't it? God, the king, his princes, and the people, all united in this wonderful new administration. Whatever comes, Whatever vicissitudes of life blow upon the fortunes of these men, this administration can care and abet them. Now, just to give you some idea of what that means in the future, here's another picture, Revelation chapter 22. It's all the same, if you like, as Psalm 72, isn't it? You can put by there Psalm 72. It just tells you in real terms exactly what it means about the covert and the hiding place and so forth. But in Revelation 22, he showed me a pure river of water of life. Place in of drought, see? See how our world's going to see in the future, isn't it? Going to come to Jerusalem, and there's going to be somebody that can heal, somebody that can provide information, can set their families right, can give guidance and direction. A pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. And in the midst of the street of it, on either side of the river, was there the tree of life, the wood of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, all kinds, and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. There should be no more curse, tempest or storm or whatever, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it. The throne of God and of the Lamb. God was in that nation, wasn't he? Guiding them. It says that in 2 Chronicles 32. And his servants shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads, reigning together. Now, if we come back to our Isaiah 32, we see the sweeping changes that are made in verses 3 to 8. As this righteousness is instituted through the land. It says in verse 3 and 4 have a different sense to the following verses. See if you can pick the sense up. And the eyes of them that see shall not be dim, and the ears of them that hear shall hearken. The heart also of the rash shall understand knowledge, and the tongue of the stammerers shall be made ready to speak plainly. That is, those who have eyes to see will see. They couldn't always see. It seemed that there was no path ahead, as though their eyes were closed. Israel were altogether like that, really, at one stage, in the 29th chapter. Verse 9 and 10. Stay yourselves and wonder. Cry ye out and cry. They are drunken, but not with mine wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For Yahweh hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and hath closed your eyes. The prophets and your rulers, the seers, hath he covered. They couldn't see. But that won't be any longer the case when this new administration comes. The eyes of them that see shall not be closed, shall not be dim. If they have eyes, they will be able to see. Now, in particular, of course, that's got reference to the Gentile peoples who did share in the joy of the deliverance from Assyria. And throwing that forward now into the future, Isaiah says in his 42nd chapter, where he speaks about giving new eyesight to people, he says, verse 6, I, Yahweh, have called thee in righteousness, and will hold thine hand, and will keep thee and give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light of the Gentiles, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. As he also puts it in verse 16, I will bring the blind by way that they knew not. I will lead them in paths that they have not known. I'll make darkness light before them, and crooked things straight. These things will I do unto them, and not forsake them. So this administration is going to teach people. Anyone who's got eyes to see is going to be able to see. They will see their prophets eye to eye. It says in chapter 30, verse 21 of the same a phenomenon. It says at the end of verse 20, but thine eyes shall see thy teachers, and thine ears shall hear a word behind thee. The eyes and the ears are open now in the change, the sweeping change that will come upon that people. So the next phrase is about their ears. In verse 3 it says, and the ears of them that hear shall hearken. There were closed minds before, but now those minds are open. It's the same sense exactly in which Jesus said, if any man have ears to hear, let him hear. And saying now in verse 3 that those people, they will hear. Again in the 42nd chapter, having said all that about the Gentiles, in verses 6 and 7 and verse 16, the prophet postulates another question. What's this about deafness and blindness? The Jew who listened to Isaiah would have said, oh, that's the Gentiles, it must be. But then in verse 18, Isaiah says this, Hear, ye deaf. Listen to what I'm saying, please. Let it go into your hearts. Hear, ye deaf, and look, ye blind, that ye may see. What's Isaiah screaming out to the Gentiles for? He's not screaming to the Gentiles. Who is blind but my servant? Israel. Or deaf as my messenger that I sent? Who is blind as he that is perfect? And blind as Yahweh's servant? Because ye say ye do not sin, therefore your sin remaineth, said Jesus in John chapter 9. So there was an application, very much an application of verses 3 and 4 of our 32nd chapter, not just to the Gentiles at large, but to Israel who were home at that time. And of course, we can imagine that there would have been a tremendous gathering coming to Jerusalem as they never came before. And the king had been so greatly honoured by the deliverance that God had given him. Now, if we come back to verse 4 of Isaiah 32, the translation seems to sort of put us off the track there just a little. It says, the heart also of the rash shall understand knowledge, and the tongue of the stammerers shall be ready to speak plainly. We might think by rash that that's describing something that is uncomely, but that's not the sense of it. The sense of it is the fearful. If you look at the 35th chapter in verse 4, the same word is translated there, fearful. You might notice a little marginal reference in 35 verse 4, which says Hebrew is hasty. It's the same word. What's 35 verse 4 saying? Well, it says, strengthen ye the weak hands, verse 3, and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a hasty heart, a fearful heart, unsure about where you're going. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with a vengeance. Even God with a recompense, he will come and save you. And so when you slip that back now into 32 verse 4, what it's saying is that those who tremble before the authority of the great men and the elders and the rich men before, they now have been strengthened and consolidated by the happenings that have occurred in Jerusalem. And the vindication over the Assyrian has allowed those men that were nobodies one time to speak up. You know, that's exactly like us, isn't it? Not many wise, not many noble, not many mighty are called. And the world would count us all together just as less than a drop in the bucket, wouldn't they? That's our lot. Unknown in the world. Just totally insignificant community. But this is going to be our opportunity when we will be able to speak who might have been hesitant to speak before. We have a boldness of declaration and a surety. There'll be strength in our knees and given power to our word to speak powerfully in that day when made kings and priests to reign with Christ 1,000 years. And that would have been exactly like that in Hezekiah's generation. All the Eliakims. You know, Shebna had it over him before, but chapter 22 says that no, Shebna will go down and Eliakim will come up. The Eliakims, the poor and needy, the faithful people, they were going to be brought forward, and their fearful heart would be consoled by the wonderful vindication that God would bring. And vice versa, verses 5 and 6, the vile person shall be no more called liberal, nor the churl said to be bountiful. The churl, the knave, the evil man is said to be liberal or bountiful. Did you see who disgraced the front of the advertiser for the last 2 days? That kind of man. Absolutely disgraceful type of person. But you see, they're lauded in today's world, aren't they? There's all kinds of that type of men with wicked backgrounds. But they're lauded in our society. But in that time, it will not be the case. The base person shall be no more called liberal, nor the churl said to be bountiful or liberal. Same word. For the vile person, and that's the word nabal, the nabal person will speak villainy, and his heart will work iniquity, to practice hypocrisy and to utter error against Yahweh. Never mind what he looks like on top. Underneath, he's essentially opposed to God. To make empty the soul of the hungry, and he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. And the last half of verse 6, my dear brothers and sisters, is intended to be all the contrast with verse 2. Verse 2 is care and thought and defence and succour for the subjects of that administration. But you see, in previous times, those who grew powerful by power corrupted themselves by destroying the interests of others. And so verse 6 speaks about their outgoing. They will be destroyed and removed as the new administration comes in. And the instruments also of the churl are evil. He deviseth wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, even when the needy speaketh right. He speaks the thing that is right to stand up for his cause. But he's crushed by the wealthy and the powerful, as of course we see in our world today. But the liberal, verse 8, the liberal, the man of generosity, the man of magnanimity, the word means, of a willing, giving spirit, he deviseth liberal things. In his mind he wishes to think of things that are elevating and uplifting, kindness and providing succour, providing a hiding place and a covert, and rivers of water in a dry place, and shadow in a weary land. He deviseth liberal things, and by liberal things shall he be vindicated, shall he stand. And so in the daily struggle, my dear brothers and sisters, in trying to keep to the right things and think about the right things in all this selfish, mad world, let's not forget to be noble, to have elevated thoughts, to be generous in our attitudes, kind in our administration, giving of ourselves to others, seeing what needs to be done, because it's that kind of person, man or woman, that God is going to look to find his administration in the future. He's like that, and therefore it must be that kind of person that rules with his king. Thank you.